What a piece of luck. We start our election campaign today.
Elections? In this place?
Of course, we make our choice every 12 months. Every citizen has a choice. Are you going to run?
Like blazes, the first chance I get.
Okay, so it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second hour this week, China has killed 20 Indian soldiers at a remote mountain border in the Himalayas. And North Korea blows up a liaison centre with South Korea. So just who is sending a signal to who there? Also, the Lockerbie bombing. David Pidstock worked on Channel 4's Maltese Double Cross documentary with Alan Frankovich that pointed to Libya definitely not being behind it. It being some squabbling and infighting going on within the Western intelligence services. And he also explains the bizarre Lockerbie 9/11 connection. And the latest instalment of the sordid tale of King George VI and Winston Churchill's alleged collaboration with Hitler's private secretary and leader of the Nazi party at the end of the war. Martin Bormann disappeared at the end of World War II and was sentenced at Nuremberg in absentia to the death penalty. The prize, though, for Winston Churchill, George VI and anyone that helped Bormann escape at the end of the war was their share in $1 billion or so US dollars worth of Nazi loot. The biggest cover-up, is it, of the 20th century? Uncovered here lie by lie. This week, two more layers of the Bormann cover-up stripped away. The author of Aftermath, Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich, Ladislas Farrago's publisher, old-school New York Times investigative journalist and former head of the New York Times book publishing arm, Thomas Lipscomb, gives us his long view after 50 years of investigative journalism on whether or not Bormann survived. And you can guess what he found out. Plus, Frank Brandenburg's 1990 book, Quest, interviews with 11 former SS Nazis, the major majority of them, confirming that Bormann did survive the war, with most of the rest blowing their top when the question was even asked. In the 1980s, two of these former, or was it current, SS men claimed to have personally met Bormann after the war, and one, Medyard Klapper, said, who's now running a gun shop, or then running a gun shop in Karlsruhe, he said he met him as recently as 1982. Also, what were the secret codes? Herr Brandenburg reveals them to let you into the Fourth Reich plotters' confidence. That's all in the second hour after six. But joining me to review this week's news is Martin Summers, Irish Republican Labour activist. Hi, Martin. I thought we'd start this week by looking at some of the incredible, well, I would say it's incredible, news about banning of things like comic films, things like Fawlty Towers, the episode to do with Don't Mention the Germans, another one to do with the Jamaican football team. Now, apparently they may now have been restored. But what do you make of this? It's almost like a sort of cultural revolution is going on where certain things that were said 30, 40 years ago have now got to be erased from history, even if they were just comedy.
Well, I think you've got to judge every individual case on its merits. As John Cleese pointed out in relation to that particular episode of Fawlty Towers, the major bloviating on about the West Indian cricket team was not... the show was not patting him on the back for being a racist. It was basically mocking him for being a racist. And of course, it's very hard to judge when people are. I mean, basically, that was basically taking the mick out of upper class racism. So the idea that this was somehow offensive rather missed the point. And of course, in actual practice, they've decided that they're not going to cover it.
Yeah, so, I mean, in a way, as a writer, if you can't send up a racist, what's the point of picking up a pen?
Well, I think that's right, but on the other hand, there are other things I've been looked at. So, for example, in Bristol this week, both St Mary Redcliffe and the Cathedral have decided that they're going to remove the stained glass windows which celebrate Edward Colston.
That, of course, is very, very different, isn't it? You've got something which is commemorating slavery and the slave trade and a particular individual. It's very different when you start... I mean, say, for example, Till Death Us Do Part, that series, which you may remember, I thought that was quite cleverly crafted to draw in a racist audience to almost... to think, oh, well, here's Alf Garnett, he's saying what we say. But actually, what the series did is it sent up Alf Garnett, didn't it? He was certainly not portrayed as a particularly bright character. Most of the time he came a cropper, and he was really the victim of the programme rather than its star.
Well, unfortunately, as the guy who wrote it, whose name I've forgotten now, said, he didn't realise that he was going to get an audience of people who actually identified with Alf Garnett. And there's no, you know, you can't fix stupid. And, you know, people are going to take things in any way they want to take them, aren't they? And a rather sad thing this week was the destruction of Skippy Africanus's gravestone in Henbury Churchyard, who was a slave who died in 1720 and was buried there. And there was a kind of a rather famous gravestone commemorating him. And somebody has gone in there and smashed it up and left a note saying that, you know, this is in revenge for the removal of Colston's statue. I think what we can say is that what's happening is there's a lot of re-examination of things which have been swept under the carpet, some of which has gone, you know, people basically like getting rid of a Fawlty Towers episode patently wrong, others less so, like the removal of Colston's statue. And then you've also got, you know, people basically vandalising what are historical records and relics in a rather unpleasant fashion. And, you know, this is how society conducts these kind of debates, isn't it?
Well, I suppose so. But then there's also the possibility, particularly, I mean, for example, things said on Twitter, an anonymous daubing of something in the middle of the night. There could be something else behind it. It's not even necessarily somebody that is a big, big fan of Edward Colston. It may be somebody who's just literally trying to, you know, push a narrative, push a debate, get people, what we call hardening the sides, isn't it? Get people sort of having to decide which side they're on.
Well, yes, and as we know in the past with things like the strategy of tension in Italy in the 1970s and so on, the people who do something might not necessarily be the people who are actually responsible. So the bombings in Piazza Fontana were blamed on the anarchists, but it ultimately came out it wasn't the anarchists who'd done it, it was the secret services. And, of course, that kind of manipulation of public opinion is very, you know, you've got to be very, very on your guard to recognise what's going on.
The mayor, apparently, this week, Marvin Rees, who's mixed race, he's been sent some racist letters, again, anonymously. It's very difficult to know who's behind it. It could be the far right, but then it could be other elements just simply trying to, I suppose, move this story on, move it into new directions, amplify this Colston message.
Well, I think what has happened is clearly the far right have been extremely exercised by what's happened, and they've worked themselves up into a bit of a frenzy about it, as we saw last weekend in London. But, of course, in the US itself, there's a very closely fought presidential election, and all sides are manipulating the narrative to try and get their people elected. And you know, you've got to take everything that everybody says with a great big pinch of salt.
Well, I mean, both of them are appalling candidates for this presidential election in the United States. Don't you think maybe if Black Lives Matter put forward as someone who is a bit more of a kind of grassroots campaigner, maybe not necessarily even black themselves, but certainly someone who's done a lot to further civil rights in the United States, they might actually stand a quite a good chance now, given the profile that Black Lives Matter has got, in beating both Biden and Trump.
Well, the problem with that is that it's a first-past-the-post rigged system, and nobody can win the presidential election now other than Biden or Trump. That's it. Because the whole thing's a stitch up. So if you ran somebody against Biden, all that would happen is you'd hand it to Trump. So that, therefore, there will be other candidates, There are always other candidates on the ballot, possibly from the Green Party, but they won't get very far because of the first past the post setup and the Electoral College. So, that, you know, and the Black Lives Matter, in any case, is a very amorphous movement. It's got lots of grassroots support, you know, like kids just emailing each other and WhatsApping and so on. But it's also got loads of ostentatious corporate support. So all these various corporations are rushing forward to say that they think that Black Lives Matter and that they identify with the cause and so on. And of course, the suspicion there is that they're basically backing Biden, and that's what that's, and they don't want Trump, and that's what this is all about.
It's certainly interesting looking at the Edward Colston statue as a kind of sideshow to the US presidential election. You know, you may be right about that, but I don't agree with you that another candidate couldn't challenge Biden or Trump, because I think there's most people are just simply in the states of voting for the lesser of two evils. If Black Lives Matter were to endorse somebody as another candidate, and a lot of other alternative radical civil rights groups, etc., are behind them, the one thing that I would say would mean they won't get elected president is if they don't get media exposure, because this is one of the things that seems to be absolutely key in actually winning one of these modern presidential elections, is how you come across in the media.
Well, in that case, you've got to have loads of money. I mean, it's quite clear that you've got to have millions of dollars to even think of running for president. If you've got to have it yourself, you've got to have them yourself, or you've got to have other people to to provide the funds. And the Black Lives Matter hasn't got a structure where it could agree an agreed candidate. It's basically a grassroots movement with a sort of corporate wing tacked on that has got quite a lot of funding. But the obvious person to run would be somebody like Tulsi Gabbard or Bernie Sanders to run as a third party candidate. They've already got media not recognition and so on, but both of them have decided to back Biden because they don't want to help Trump, and that's the reality of where we're at.
It's so horrendous, isn't it? What a horrible system. You can't really call it democracy at all. Anyway, Martin, I don't know if you watched any of it, but it's been on the BBC this week. It's called The Salisbury Poisonings, a drama about what really happened down in Salisbury 2 years ago. Did you watch any of it?
I've been reading Craig Murray's rather useful debunking of it.
Well, I watched about 10 seconds, well, not 10 seconds, maybe 20, 30 seconds of it. It was like watching paint dry, but I thought it's quite useful maybe to share what your thoughts are on some of the major holes in this, because it seems to me that nowadays we're looking at, say, for example, with the Flight 93 film after 9/11, when one of these big events takes place, the idea is that there is an official narrative of what really happened, which doesn't really make any sense. But in order to try and make sense of it, there is then a drama and a film made to say, oh, well, this is what really happened. Now, obviously, there are a lot of problems with what really did happen in Salisbury and a lot of things that don't add up at all. So what would you like to point to as regards the Skripal poisonings that, you know, that doesn't seem to make any sense about it?
Well, the first thing to point out is that if you really intended to prosecute somebody for doing this, and they've named certain Russians that they claim are responsible, then you don't make a film like this accusing them of being guilty in the first place, because then they wouldn't get a fair trial if they ever came to trial. So it's quite clear they've no intention of having any kind of trial about any of this. So this is why the BBC, who are basically playing their role here as state broadcaster of Britain, they've basically got a military advisors for this programme. So the intelligence services and the military are advising them on what should go in the programme. So let's get absolutely clear about what this programme is. It is grade A propaganda. And the other thing, is that the basic things that are wrong about this, that one of the things that Craig Murray pointed out was in the very first episode, they were saying that although there was Novichok everywhere all over the place, nobody died because it was too cold, and therefore in other words, they're coming up with explanations of what happened, which we didn't even hear at the time. And basically, it's shoddy propaganda. That's what it is.
One of the problems is if you develop a complicated lie like it does appear the whole episode in Salisbury is, it's very difficult to get everyone to agree to the same lie. Someone will think, you know, it might start accidentally introducing the truth into the narrative and then making it so it doesn't work. But anyway, this week I spoke to Steve Brody about Porton Down, which is just down the road from Salisbury, because we know many times in the past they've lied. We also know that they've had to pay out millions of pounds in compensation to people they lied to. So I thought it'd be interesting to have a chat to him about his during the noughties, mainly exposing the lies that have been told by Porton Down, which of course was just only about 10 minutes, 15 minutes drive down the road from Salisbury, the British chemical and biological weapons plant that under international treaties shouldn't even exist. One of the terms which Steve uses in the interview is the Porton Down gas chamber. So they were poisoning people in that gas chamber and killing too.
They were basically carrying out all sorts of unethical experiments, were they not, in the 1950s on national service personnel who were told that they were going to be, you know, let off normal duties provided they went to Porton Down to research into the common cold.
Well, one of the interesting things Steve told me, which is not on the interview, is that I said to him, well, what about Fort Detrick in the United States? And he said, well, actually, the Americans were quite a few years behind us. And then he added, and we were quite a few years behind the Germans, because much of the sarin nerve gas, this particularly nasty stuff, was actually developed in Nazi Germany and brought over to Porton Down at the end of the Second World War.
Yeah, so in other words, a lot of the same thing happened with the Japanese experiments that the Kempeitai carried out in China. They were given all sorts of basically protection, so that provided they passed on all of the research that they'd been doing into chemical and biological weapons. And as we know, chemical and biological warfare, it is banned, and there's supposed to be a ban against it.
What is Porton Down doing as a weapons, chemical and biological weapons plant when such plants are not supposed to exist, Martin?
Well, the justification in the West is that somebody at some point might develop a chemical and biological warfare capacity, so we've got to carry on researching it to find out whether they are. And it was massively ramped up after 9/11 as a result of the anthrax attacks, if people remember those, which kills six people, I believe, and potentially kills lots more. But, of course, it then transpired that the anthrax, which was supposedly sent by Islamist militants, turned out to come from Fort Detrick itself. And then there was a big investigation of one individual who was blamed for it, who clearly wasn't responsible. And it was part of the process. The people who were sent these anthrax letters were the Congress people who were likely to vote against the Patriot Act. So it was clearly a provocation from within the US security forces. There's a whole load of questions underlying all of this. And of course, I sent you stuff from James Bamford yesterday about, because he's collated all of the evidence that suggests that this COVID-19 may be a biological weapon, but not a Chinese biological weapon, a Western biological weapon of the kind that they've used in North Korea and in Cuba previously.
I've also got a couple of, I think, interesting articles, one by an Israeli intelligence officer and another one anonymously giving, I think it's the Saker, it was when on the Saker blog, which give a completely different story of what happened in Salisbury. Anyway, I'm hoping we're able to hear Steve Brody now, so let's have a listen to him.
My name is Steve Brody. I was the Home Affairs correspondent for BBC Television News in the West Country for nearly 30 years. Before that, I was a newspaper reporter, and then I moved into local radio. I was one of the members that launched the GWR franchise in the West, and I was deputy head of news there. And then I moved on to the launch of BBC Wiltshire Sound in Swindon, where I was the news editor. And indeed, I'm still working as a freelance, despite having retired full-time working from the BBC.
You have investigated Porton Down, particularly deaths of servicemen there. Can you tell me how the investigation started when you first came across the story?
Absolutely. I was driving home along the M4 in the summer of 1999, and phone went, and chap, police contact. And he said, would I be interested in an investigation into what he said was the goings-on at Porton Down? Well, I thought for about a millisecond and said, yes, I would. I'd be very interested indeed. And that led to one of the most extraordinary investigations I've ever been involved in. I was particularly proud that I broke the story on television, particularly proud about that. It turned out that the kernel of the whole thing was the fact that a young man who's only 20 years old had died in the gas chamber at Porton Down in 1953. He had gone there because he had been told he would get an additional 4 shillings and 6 pence a week if he took part in a programme to find a cure for the common cold. Complete nonsense. It wasn't a cure for the common cold. It was an experiment with sarin nerve gas on young servicemen and volunteers who were asked to go to Porton Down, and he died. And that was the beginning of an extraordinary investigation which involving the police force, the MOD, the government, and sundry other people from the secret services.
So I understand it was a secret inquest originally.
Yes.
Of this man. His name, Ronald Madison, I believe.
His name was Ronald Madison. He was a 20-year-old airman in 1953 doing his national service. And why was he at Porton Down? Well, in the last months of the Second World War, Tony, as the Allies advanced through Germany, the British Army came upon stockpiles of nerve gas. Within 2 weeks of the Army unit that discovered this stockpile of nerve gas, experiments were being run at Porton Down in Wiltshire, the chemical and biological warfare research establishment, highly secret. But it's quite astonishing. The war was still going on, and volunteers were being asked to go to Porton Down and were being tested by the nerve gas which had been discovered, stockpiled in Germany. And those experiments didn't stop at the end of the war. The Cold War came along, and the establishment, as it were, wanted to see how people would survive alleged nerve gas attacks. And Ronald Madison went to Porton Down. One morning in May, he went into the gas chamber there, and he had a patch of army uniform taped to his arm. This patch was taped to his arm, and onto that patch was dropped in a liquid form 200 millilitres of sarin nerve gas, one of the most desperately lethal gases known to man, 26 times more lethal than cyanide. Within 23 minutes, he had died from the most terrible reaction to the poison, rushed to the hospital in Porton Down, and died. Quite a terrible thing. It is a scandal that it happened. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
Let's just be clear here. Is this a liquid or a gas?
It was in liquid form. It can be in different forms. Sarin nerve gas can be delivered in different forms. And they were experimenting. The scientists at Porton were experimenting to see, basically, how much it takes to kill somebody. And Ronald Madison died.
So he was a human guinea pig. I mean, this reminds us almost of the sorts of Nazi experiments on people.
Oh, completely. In fact, that's one of the comments that has been made in the last 60 or 70 years, that these experiments mirrored what was happening in Nazi Germany. Truly appalling, and we all obviously think that's terrible. But in fact, similar experiments were happening here in the UK.
OK, so what about the investigations? An internal one at Porton Down, a coroner's inquest, and police?
Well, what happened, in May of 1953, he died, and there was an inquest. And it was held in Salisbury, which is quite ironic, given the goings-on recently involving Novichok. And there was an inquest, before a coroner in the city of Salisbury in Wiltshire, behind closed doors. Behind closed doors. Nobody admitted.
Is it something like a military tribunal type thing?
Not really, no, no. It was
why
a pro-
should it, how can you have an inquest behind closed
Well, the culture is different then, Tony. Remember, this is 1953. Allegedly, the Soviets were knocking on the door. And the government, that's their argument in any case, and it was from a secret establishment. So the inquest was held, and the coroner returned a verdict of misadventure. His parents, Ronald Manson's parents, were never told, never told the truth, never told the outcome of the inquest. Meanwhile, another investigation was going on at Porton Down by the scientists who had in fact carried out the experiments in the first place. And they concluded that he died from nerve gas, from sarin nerve gas. They didn't mess about. They knew what killed him. That too was in secret, and that too was never revealed for another 50 years.
What about the police? Did they get it wrong?
The police did not do an investigation into the death of Ronald Manson, because it happened on a government establishment, and the verdict delivered by the coroner was misadventure. So there was no need to do an investigation. So Wiltshire Police, in 1953, did not investigate what happened to Ronald Manson.
Were there any others that managed to survive these tests?
Well, of course, actually, Ronald Manson was desperately unlucky. He was duped into going there, for a start. At the time, throughout the UK, in barrack rooms and on ships and airfields, posters were going up, and or actually orders, standing orders, which is a very legal difference between that. It's lawyers could argue about that all day, and indeed did, saying, go for a week at Porton Down, help find a cure for the common cold. And hundreds of young servicemen did indeed go to Porton Down over the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and actually into the 80s. And this went on, and it would have continued to go on, apart from a man called Gordon Bell. He was another young serviceman who had three experiments on him at Porton Down, and he survived. But he turned into a whistleblower, one of the great whistleblowers. Not particularly well known, but within the circles of this particular incident, very well known. He, in 1999, went to Wiltshire Police. He actually was living in Canada, and he came over from Canada, and he went to see Wiltshire Police and made his claims about the fact that these experiments had been taking place on young men without their knowledge. Duped, in other words. And indeed, to their credit, Wiltshire Police thought, well, yeah, well, this needs looking into. And what happened was that a head of CID then, a policeman called Detective Superintendent Jerry Luckett, he filmed a team of officers to investigate this. He persuaded the Crown Prosecution Service that this was worth doing. And they sort of said, OK, all right. So off they went. And the background to this is quite astonishing. These Wiltshire detectives went to America. They went to the Pentagon. They actually went to the Pentagon and were shown top-secret files about what the Americans were doing with sarin nerve gas, because they got the samples from the Brits. And indeed, they were given access. They talked to people. They took the files away. Quite extraordinary. And came back. So we've got the police doing this investigation into a criminal offence. A criminal offence. On the other hand, you know, why had it gone on? Who had authorised this? And what happened was that the police said in August 1999, and I was part of it, because I was part of the investigation, which was very rare to be asked to be part of an investigation of this level. Clearly, I didn't go to the Pentagon, but I was being informed of this throughout this extraordinary investigation. And In August 1999, Wiltshire Police announced that they would be investigating the death of Ronald Madison some 50-odd years after his death. And that the MOD, or in essence Porton Down, would be facing charges of assault and corporate manslaughter. Cue, Tony, uproar.
Now, for those that survived these experiments, did they describe what it was like to be poisoned
the moment the BBC revealed that this was happening, and as I say, cue uproar, every journalist in the country was running around frantically trying to find out what was going on in Porton Down. We at the BBC were bombarded with letters, hundreds of letters, it's quite extraordinary, hundreds of letters from colonels, from majors, from privates, basically all ranks in the armed forces contacted the BBC and said, oh, hold on, I took part in that. And one of the great lines which was often repeated in these letters from young soldiers, young airmen, young sailors, saying, they asked their NCOs, you know, should I volunteer for this thing at Porton Down? And this was often repeated. Senior NCO said, actually, young man, never volunteer for anything in the army, and particularly do not volunteer for anything at Porton Down. A giveaway line, a light-hearted line, but absolutely true. Absolutely true. I travel the country talking to people about their experiences, and particularly Gordon Bell, the whistleblower, who had cancers. A lot of these people, Tony, a lot of these people who I spoke to have certainly since died, and many were ill at the time, with unrelated illnesses from the experiments at Porton Down. Hundreds.
So did they ever describe what it was like to be given sarin nerve gas?
Oh, yes.
To survive?
Well, they were ill. The dose, obviously, was way too high. That was the thing. It was delivered in 20 drops onto this patch on his forearm.
I understand it gave you sort of tunnel vision.
Oh.
They're breathing.
Breathing. It's a respiratory illness.
One person described it was like breathing through a tiny straw.
Yes.
So it was very difficult to breathe.
It is. You die slowly. Well, it took Ronald Madison 23 minutes to die, but if you're conscious of that, it's a thoroughly, thoroughly unpleasant experience. And, of course, it was meant to be. It was to wipe out lots of people.
So this investigation by the BBC and by the police, how did Porton Down take that?
No comment. Yes, that was the bottom line. And it's very interesting, when it started, Jerry Luckett, said to me, he said, this will be a lengthy investigation. And he was right. 4 years later, they were still doing it. So we'd moved on into the new decade. And I have to remind myself, actually, a year or two later, it was quite interesting. Eventually, the government gave Wiltshire Police a £900,000 grant, which was quite a lot of money in 2001, to carry out the investigation, to continue to carry out the investigation. Very unusual. And so the investigation went on. Detectives, rather like me, but in probably much better style, travelled up and down the country, meeting these people and gathering evidence. And eventually, a year after that, the Crown Prosecution Service took a very controversial decision. The Crown Prosecution Service decided that there was not enough evidence for a criminal investigation. The Porton Down Veterans Association, these men were no longer young men, they were in their 50s and 60s and 70s. Took that very badly indeed. Very badly indeed. And one of the excuses was from the Crown Prosecution Service was that all the scientists who had taken part in these experiments in the 50s and 60s and 70s had died. So therefore there couldn't be a criminal investigation. I have to say, I thought that was a poor, very poor decision. One wonders whether it was a political decision, but of course there is no evidence to say that. There is no evidence whatsoever to say that. And it would be wrong to say it, because certainly the BBC tried to look, and I looked, and we couldn't find any evidence of that. But that was the bottom line, no criminal investigation.
So it did come to court, though, didn't it, in the High Court in 2002?
It did. In 2002, David Masters, the then coroner for Wiltshire, an excellent guy, very unusual to find a coroner like David Masters. He took the whole thing very seriously. And he applied to the Crown Court. He applied to the High Court for permission to quash the verdict of the 1953 inquest in Salisbury. He applied to the High Court for permission to quash the verdict and to reopen the inquest. It's one, if not the greatest distance between inquests being finished and then reopened in British legal history. One of them. There's bound to be one somewhere else, which I don't know about. So we all went off to the High Court in front of the then Lord Chief Justice, Lord Wolfe. And I don't know if you've been to the High Court, but to menial hacks and journalists sit right at the bottom in the front row, and the Lord Chief Justice is up there. It is a Dickensian court. They're all being modernised now, but it was in those days, it was a Dickensian court. And in sweeps Lord Justice Wolfe. Place was packed, absolutely packed with veterans, families, Ronald Madison surviving family, and journalists. I was quite surprised. He took very little time sweeping aside any arguments why he should not quash the verdict, and said, yes, I'm quashing it, and the coroner and Evans and would you please continue their investigation? Thank you and good night, and swept out. And there was a rather bizarre incident in the middle of this desperately, desperately serious investigation. It was right at the core of how we govern in this country. Jerry Luckett said to me, Steve, said, come to the back of the court, I'd like you to meet some people. So we trolled off. I thought, must be a good witness or another victim. Excellent, that's what, as you know, that's what journalists want. They want to talk to people who are there and all the rest of it. So we went to the back of court number 3 in the High Court, and there were two pretty serious-looking gents in smart suits who weren't looking very pleased. And Jerry Luckett went up to these two chaps. He said, I'd like to introduce Steve Brodie from the BBC. Steve Brodie, meet MI5. Something out of the Corrid novel or Spooks. And we all said hello, and there were a bit of an uncomfortable shuffling of feet, and that was it.
So they'd lost?
Oh, yes. They'd lost.
So this then preceded the inquest.
Well, what happened was, the coroner said to the police force, gather me evidence, and I'm going to open an inquest. It took another year before it... This went on for such a long time, to 2004. For the inquest to be set up, the terms of the inquest, where it was going to be held, and eventually they decided on, of all places, Trowbridge. It's quite weird.
Well, that's probably one of the nearest courts.
Yes.
So maybe the best place to do it. What about pressure on the coroner during that inquest?
Well,
is there any?
That's a very good point. This was, after all, the Ministry of Defence, backed by the government, obviously, the establishment put them down, who clearly did not want this to happen under any circumstances. And just before the inquest, the government sort of began to weaken slightly and agreed to have a health survey of surviving members of the Portland Down Volunteers, the group of men. And that was the first thing. They decided to do a statistical study of how these men, how they lived, what illnesses had they had. And that was quite significant. And of course, it turned out that, that most of these people had a very high incidence of cancer and various other things. But that was an interesting development. The government had weakened slightly and okayed that study. So that brings us to the inquest. And I can always remember that David Masters made it perfectly clear. And I think it's actually worth quoting him, because, you know, it was one of those landmark moments. And he opened the inquest and he said, "I want to make it clear the facts will be fully, fairly and fiercely investigated. This will be a transparent inquest." And it was.
So the family, Ronald Manners's family, still alive?
Yes. Well, his sister, Lilias, was 18 when he died in 1953, and very emotional. They sat through this inquest, which was going to last 2 months, and it lasted six. A six-month inquest. And she... at the end of it, she actually said to me, she said, you know, he didn't have a life. They took it away from him. And she was right. 20-year-old serviceman. The inquest itself was fascinating. It was harrowing. And it produced a series of facts which really, quite frankly, beggars belief about how these people were duped. And interestingly, expert witnesses were called, obviously no scientists, because they were dead. And in fact, David Masters, the coroner, made that point. And he actually said, he warned the jury, it was a jury inquest, he warned the jury that the credibility of evidence produced by scientists from Porton Down lacked credibility. He said, you know, I urge you not to take too much notice of it, which in itself, for a coroner to say that, an inquest of this magnitude was another landmark moment. And then I'm sure you can remember the Bristol baby death scandal involving a very high number of deaths involving babies at the Bristol Royal Infirmary. And Sir Ian Kennedy, who carried out the inquiry into that, was called as an expert witness, and he said that Ronald Manison and these young men had been duped ethically. And again, I think it's worth reminding ourselves exactly what Sir Ian Kennedy said. He said that scientists at the time had acted beyond what was ethically acceptable, and that Ronald Madison and the others had been exposed to uncontrollable dangers, and that the test shouldn't have taken place.
So the obvious question is, did this inquest take place because those who had administered this nerve agent to these people were dead and couldn't themselves personally be prosecuted?
I'm not sure about that. I think they would have been called. I think they undoubtedly would have been called. The inquest took place because of a whistleblower had the courage to come across the Atlantic and talk to Wiltshire Police, and Wiltshire Police decided to take him seriously.
So was this idea of testing people for the common cold, was anyone really ever tested for it?
After all this, after 5 years, it was discovered by Wiltshire Police in laboratory records at Porton Down that the establishment had never, ever undertaken any research into finding a cure for the common cold.
So the whole thing was a front? The Common
yes.
Cold Research Centre?
Yes.
Because that was where many people came, wasn't
was
it?
That was separate. But at Porton Down itself, in the Chemical and Biological Warfare Centre, Research Centre, it never happened there.
So these servicemen went to Porton Down, not to the Common Cold Research Centre?
They went to Porton Down.
Okay, so what about the verdict at the inquest?
Well, after 6 months, we'd had these dramatic discussions Indeed, there were discussions of how you died, how you felt in the gas chamber at Porton, and we produced these hitherto unseen pictures of people on trainbacks going backwards and forwards with full masks on. It was something like out of a horror film. Just terrible. Well, of course, there were three possible verdicts. There was misadventure, the same as in 1953, an open verdict. A misadventure, I think, was highly unlikely. None of us thought it would be misadventure. The danger was, from the family's point of view and from the police's point of view, that it could have been an open verdict, which would have left everything hanging in the air. It would have been, no questions would have been answered, and it would have been a disaster. Or unlawful killing. Unanimously, the jury, absolutely bang on the money, said unlawful killing, which is exactly what the police wanted and what the family wanted. And I have to say, one should never, ever get involved in the emotions of these events. Then you lose clarity and you lose discretion and you lose objectivity, and you mustn't do that as a journalist. You mustn't do that. But I have to say, I thought, yes, a good result. And I thought that was very, very important. And of course, it did open up. It opened up quite important. It opened up the possibility of a compensation and further legal action. And it thoroughly embarrassed the government, and it thoroughly embarrassed Porton Down.
So what's your feeling about the whole affair, looking back on it?
Well, I think that it was something that had to be done. The fact that it took over 50 years to get to that stage. And I think that, to sum it up, it was a huge and disgraceful episode in British history. Balanced against that, of course. And you must find balance. The culture was different. It was the Cold War. When, in fact, the value of the individual was somewhat reduced. And as I said before, the government was arguing that the Soviets were knocking on the door, and, in fact, the Soviets were carrying out exactly the same experiments. And you could say there was no difference, because in Russia you certainly wouldn't be able to say, no, I'm not taking part. But we were no better. The UK was no better. In a way, morally, probably worse, because people were duped into going, and that's very wrong indeed. And after this, statistically it was found out that around about 20,000 people from about 1946 to 1989 had taken part in experiments at Porton Down, not necessarily with sarin nerve gas. That would be wrong to say that. The problem was that it was all unnecessary. And why deny it? This is the denying taking place. And, of course, it spawned all sorts of other theories, not all entirely proved. For instance, David Kelly was head of biological experiments at Porton Down, and we all know what happened to him and why did it happen to him. But that's, of course, a separate story. And if you want me to sum it up, I think that Wiltshire Police, a force which I have to say has had its ups and downs, came out with an immense credit for a small rural force to carry out this sort of investigation. It cost in the end £3 million, which is an astonishing amount of money for Wiltshire Police. And to see a traditional and establishment figure like David Masters, who held his nerve and indeed made sure that the truth was found. The good guys actually won for once.
In January 2008, there were compensation payments.
Indeed.
£8,300 per person. Around about 350 people.
Yes. Princely sum, wasn't it?
And that's how much it costs to have nerve gas put on you.
Yes.
Were these all with sarin nerve gas, or were there other substances?
It's unknown.
Okay, so they wouldn't say.
They wouldn't say.
There is a saying, apparently, at Porton Down, never apologise, never explain.
I've never seen that written down.
No. They don't write things down like that. Also, in 2015, you mentioned a lot of guinea pigs, 22,000 or so, between around about 1940 and 1990. But there are also, the records were revealed in 2015, something like 750 secret operations by Porton Down around Britain, testing biological agents on the general population, including places like the London Underground. Well, I wonder if any information about this came out.
Oh, well, actually, Tony, much closer to home. Much closer to home. The whole of the South West and Bristol in particular was experimented on. Only people at the time didn't know. A plume of substances were put up into the air, and it drifted across the South West. The idea was to see what would happen if an atomic bomb went off, and how many people would die, and how long it would take to people die. And that was thrown up during the BBC investigation, and I remember doing a very long piece about this, and got the science on it, and got the paperwork. At the time, Porton Down refused. There was an argument that there was some radioactivity released. Couldn't prove it, and Porton Down denied it. And I actually think, even by Porton Down standards, I think that's highly unlikely. But the experiment certainly took place across Bristol and the southwest to see how far the wind would blow radiation particles.
And that's just one of 750 of these experiments.
Well, it's the only one that I investigated, and I can talk about that with some clarity, but the others I don't know.
Now, when I was working in Salisbury, I can remember this question about Gulf War syndrome.
Yes.
This is something else, yes. I think, which people have pointed the finger at Porton Down over, saying what that was happening with soldiers going out to the first Gulf War in 1990 were given a lot of injections.
They were.
And I wonder what you make of that, because obviously Porton Down would have been involved in the sorts of treatments, whatever was given to people. They would have experimented on these substances beforehand, possibly.
Yes. I didn't do any work on the Gulf War syndrome, so I can't answer you. But I can say that probably 40 years ago, definitely 40 years ago, I went into the gas chamber at Porton Down. And this was all before this. And interviewed the head of the establishment, and it was all extremely polite. And I didn't really take it that seriously. It was an unpleasant feeling. But, of course, if I had known what I know now, you wouldn't have found me within 500 yards of the place. In fact, probably a mile. There was a well-known theory about Gulf War syndrome, but I haven't done an investigation of that, so I can't answer it.
The other thing I must ask you about is the 4th of March 2018, we had the Salisbury poisonings.
Now, indeed.
This is only 10 minutes away from Porton Down. I mean, some people have said, well, isn't it possible that whatever substance was used in Salisbury just was from 10 minutes away, rather than from somewhere across the world?
Yes. I think, on the other hand, if it hadn't been, 15 minutes away, 20 minutes actually, I don't know how far do you drive, Tony.
probably too far.
Yes, I think that on the balance, it was possibly, if there was, and if we agree with the government on this, that there was a chemical weapons attack on a British city, then it was just as well it was 15 minutes away from Porton Down. I don't think anywhere else in the country would have had the faintest idea what they were dealing with. And ordinary people in Salisbury, decent ordinary people, would probably have died. The information came back very quickly from Porton Down. The argument, the morality of Porton Down, of course, is another subject altogether. Vaccines have been developed there. They are, we believe, we are told, are working on a vaccine for COVID-19, which will not be a bad thing. It would prevent the deaths of perhaps hundreds of thousands of people. I think the evidence is still waiting to see where we are.
There's
with Nokhachev.
There's one particular question about this attack in Salisbury, and that is that, judging by the experiments on soldiers, this is incredibly lethal material. I would have imagined that if this had been a professional state operation, that both Sergei and Yulia Skripal would not still be with us. This is incredibly dangerous stuff.
Indeed.
A little tiny drop of it will kill you. Mm. How come they're still alive?
You'd have to ask the scientists. I do think that if the information that has come out is to be believed, that the alleged two government Russian agents were having a fun time with a prostitute and doing a bag of weed the night before, may sort of impair their expertise, perhaps, when they went down for the second time, after scoping out Salisbury to go down for the second time. They weren't at their best, perhaps. I think what we need to know is we need to know the investigation, the criminal investigation into what was murder, made public. And of course, as you know, you can't make that information public until there has been a trial, if there will be a trial. And of course, it's quite obvious that it's highly unlikely that the two alleged Russian agents will ever be extradited from Moscow to come and face a trial at Winchester. I don't think it's going to happen. It should happen, and then we will know the evidence. Until we know the evidence, I don't think we can make a statement.
Okay, there's another aspect, Portendale, and that is slowly over the last 20 years or so, there has been talk of and there has been a degree of privatisation. Do you think that's changed the way it works?
I'm uncomfortable with it being privatised. You bring the profit motive in, and people may take shortcuts. I'm not saying that there's lack of expertise. The expertise may remain the same. But I'm uncomfortable with something so important to the country being put in the hands of private industry, where history tells us shortcuts are taken in the effort to satisfy the shareholders. I think I would prefer, if we are to have a research establishment, it should be controlled by the government.
There is a worldwide ban on chemical and biological weapons. Should Portendown even exist?
Well, there's been a ban since 1989 about experiments on human beings at Portendown. That ended in 1989. There was a ban imposed by the government on the use of human beings at Portendown, which is often sometimes forgotten. And that's what happened. I think we can only look upon our own experiences. COVID-19, is the last count, and it's caused 42,000 deaths in this country. And I would prefer to know what was going to kill me or what's going to kill my family, and could do something about it. If it's not there.
Couldn't that be done on a civilian program? Why military? Why are the military still experimenting with these substances when there's a worldwide ban in place?
You'd have to ask them.
The inquest was carried out by this chap, David Masters.
Mm.
Do you think the same sort of thing could still happen today?
You'd like to think so, wouldn't you? I'd like to think so. But he was an exceptional coroner. There have been one or two in the West Country. There have been one or two. And you've met another one.
Paul Forrest from Raven Somerset.
Indeed. Another exceptional coroner of the same generation, I might add. I don't know. We haven't seen any mistakes yet. And if there are mistakes made, they will have to look into them. But David Masters was exceptional. He gave great access to the media. Well, he gave great access to the BBC and indeed others. And wasn't for turning. He stood up to the establishment and made sure there was a properly carried out inquest. And he got to the bottom of it.
There is an aspect with public officials now that sometimes they cherry-pick journalists. So if a journalist is quite critical, then that journalist may be blacklisted and won't get the stories, won't get cooperation from their press office and that sort of thing. Have you seen that in coroner's offices? Have you seen that in your work over the last 10, 15 years, where if you report negatively on somebody, that a public official, then you may find yourself cut off from getting interviewed?
Well, I think it depends. If you get it right, if you get it right, then you're right, and they can do nothing about it. Most people would say that I've been a bit at odds with the establishment for most of my career. My experience is that the first thing is to get it right. Check the facts. Prove it. Have the evidence. And put it to them. And if they don't like you, you broadcast it. And then they're left looking silly. My experience is that as long as you don't lie, I find that very, very disagreeable fact that some journalists spin it before actually getting the facts, and I'm not a supporter of that whatsoever. If you cross them, well, that's just part of it. If you fall out with them, you fall out with them. I've fallen out with one or two in my career. But I've also had good experiences, and one of them was Porton Down. I like to think that I played a very minor part in exposing what had happened at Porton Down.
So that's Steve Brodie, former Home Affairs correspondent for BBC in the West of England. Martin, quite a lot to discuss from that, but I suppose one of the main things is at the inquest, as Steve described there, they're talking about the Porton Down evidence lacking credibility. This is the coroner himself saying this evidence you're putting forward lacks credibility.
Well, I mean, what you're seeing there is that the state is not a monolith. So the Crown Prosecution Service and the Wiltshire Police, who are paid for out of general taxation, are not necessarily on the same page of Porton Down, which again is paid for out of general taxation.
Well, just to be clear, with the Crown Prosecution Service, were not at all helpful. They made sure there was no criminal investigation into these deaths, which would possibly have meant some of the scientists or lab assistants, people like that, maybe even former directors of Porton Down would have gone to jail. But certainly the coroner and the local police force in Wiltshire showed their independence to these national institutions.
Yeah, but they're not in 1954, they didn't. But, it's a harrowing story. And frankly, I have to say that it's probably the tip of the iceberg of what's really been going on there for all these years. Your point that you were making to your interviewee there about, should Porton Down exist at all, I think that's a very good point. Why do you need military investigation into these things when there's a worldwide ban on these weapons? And don't forget that Putin talked to Assad after the supposed chemical weapons attack at Douma, which of course we now probably, pretty obviously wasn't carried out by the Syrians anyway. It was carried out by the rebels, probably supplied by our intelligence services, possibly from Porton Down. The Syrians got rid of their chemical weapons because they don't have a real use in modern warfare. They were never much use in the first place. In the First World War, the chemical weapons were very, they basically blew back over your own troops and all sorts of things like that. They were used by Saddam in the Gulf War, in the Iran-Iraq War, but of course that was all supplied by the West as well, as we all know.
And the big scandal, of course, really, that Steve helped expose there was the lies told not only to the original inquest, but also to those hundreds and hundreds of servicemen that thought they were going to get a little bit of extra pay by being tested for the common cold. They ended up being guinea pigs for the most lethal substance known to man.
Well, yes. And that's the sort, I mean, there's also the story about what happened in Lynmouth, because the RAF were testing, this come out under freedom of information legislation. They were testing rainmaking on Exmoor, and they successfully made rain on Exmoor, and at Cranford they'd all got the bubbly out, and they were saying, this is great, we've managed to make rain. But that's what led to the Lynmouth flood, which killed 15 people, which of course has been treated ever since as if it was just a natural disaster, but it wasn't.
There's also these hundreds of tests by Portendown. I mean, I don't think anyone's saying that they were necessarily releasing sarin nerve gas on the public, but they were doing these tests to see how quickly substances spread around. And they were using bacteria which and various substances which hadn't really been properly tested, so it could have actually caused harm too. The other thing, of course, is the Wiltshire gas chamber. I didn't actually realise that Wiltshire had its own gas chambers and probably still does.
Well, I mean, I don't know anything about the Wiltshire gas chambers, so it's hard to comment. But I think the story around what happened to the Skripals just doesn't add up. I mean, if they were using Novichok, A, they'd be dead, and B, lots of other people would be dead. And of course, the programme that the BBC is showing doesn't mention that the first person on the scene just happened to be the most senior nurse in the British Army and various other anomalies in the British story.
She was from the Air Force, wasn't she?
Well, she was a senior military nurse.
Yeah, I mean, also she just happened to be.
I mean, that only came out because her daughter, who was with her, got some award from a local radio station, and her mother came along with her and said that she would. So, in other words, just by coincidence, she just happened to be there. And of course, they also have the doctor at Salisbury General Hospital who wrote to the Times saying, "We have not treated anybody for nerve agents in this hospital today," and that includes Skripal and his daughter, because what they were initially treated for, because it looked like a drugs overdose, fentanyl or something of that sort. Novichok doesn't work like that. Novichok just kills you dead. You don't go for to the pub and to the restaurant and all these other places, and they supposedly picked it up off a doorknob. And then they went out for a pub lunch and feed the ducks. And then some hours later, both of them are found frothing at the mouth on a bench. And then just so happens by the senior military nurse in the British Army or the British military. Now, nothing of that will come out in this BBC documentary film, whatever it is that they've made. And of course, it's that the you can sense that there's some kind of psychological warfare narrative creation here.
Most people looking at what happened in Salisbury will be thinking, well, what could possibly be the motive? But we know, don't we, that there is a secret intelligence operation, not necessarily so secret, because I believe it was a French former intelligence officer that revealed it, called Operation Beluga, the idea being to basically blacken the name of Russia to smear Putin in the international press. And it could simply be an intelligence operation named Beluga.
Well, it's Beluga. People can look this up. It was Paul Burrell, who was a head of the French anti-terrorist squad, who told us the name of the operation. And basically, also the death of Berezovsky. The coroner in Surrey refused to sign it off as suicide. Now, you'd have thought that the media in the West, when Berezovsky, Putin's major political opponent, supposedly commits suicide, but it turns out it wasn't suicide, and the coroner wouldn't accept that it was suicide, you'd have thought they'd have picked that up and blasted it all over the place like Litvinenko. But they didn't. They didn't, because Berezovsky's daughter has been on Russian TV to say, as far as she's concerned, it was the British who killed Berezovsky. And of course, you then get into this kind of what you've got in the mainstream media and mainstream establishment opinion in the West is, we don't do things like that, so that can't have happened. Although in actual fact, if you're Russian, it's quite straightforward. The British killed him, because the British do kill people. The idea that we don't do stuff like that is just for the birds, isn't it?
Well, and also I think we have to give a big pat on the back to Jerry Luckett and the CID at Wiltshire Constabulary for pursuing basically the entire establishment they took on when they took on that inquest.
Yes, and of course some of the people have got compensation, but of course the truth is that many of them probably had long-term health issues as a result of being exposed to these substances.
And as Steve pointed out, many of them, of course, are dead as well. The other aspect to all of this is Dr. David Kelly and his mysterious death in 2003. Steve mentioned there.
Yes. Well, I mean, we're now ranging out across all the sort of things that go on. But the fact of the matter is,
Wally Martin, no, because Kelly was one of the chief scientific officers at Portendown,
yes,
wasn't he?
Yes. And of course, he was involved in the trip to South Africa with David Cameron and Sir
Kenneth Warren.
To negotiate about what was going to happen to South Africa's nuclear weapons at the end of apartheid. Basically, the British deep state is as devious as you could possibly imagine.
I mean,
it's just wrong.
That whole trip has an aspect of white supremacist to it, doesn't it? Because they didn't want nuclear weapons to fall into the hand of the black majority rule in South Africa.
No, they didn't. And the other thing that they were doing in South Africa was weaponizing anthrax for use in artillery shells, which could then be fired into the townships. As you can imagine, the more you look into the arms industry, the military intelligence establishment, the intelligence services, the dirtier it all gets. And of course, the idea that these people are basically good guys and we don't need to know what they're up to because they're basically protecting us from evil is simply wrong. It's just wrong.
So there are a couple of books on the death of David Kelly, aren't there? There's one by Norman Baker, I think he was, Lib Dem MP, and another one by Miles Goslett more recently, both of whom actually I've interviewed about their books. And many people didn't realise, Martin, that he even had a connection with Porton Down, the Nuclear and Chemical and Biological Weapons Research Centre.
He was somebody who, classically, somebody who knew too much. And again, what happened there was no coroner's inquest because you can't commit suicide in the way that they suggested he committed suicide. So there wasn't a coroner's inquest. Tony Blair went straight to an inquiry to avoid having a coroner's inquest. And what this shows, in fact, and the same with what happened with Berezovsky, is that if you can get the genuine machinery of the judiciary to operate, then you can start to look into what the deep state gets up to. And of course, we saw this also in Italy with Imposimato, the head of the Supreme Court there, investigating all of the terrorism associated with Gladio. The fact is, ultimately, we're going to have to turn honest coppers on the deep state. That's the strategy.
Okay, so thank you very much to Martin Summers there and also to former West of England BBC Home Affairs correspondent Steve Brodie for taking us right the way, really, I think, very thorough investigation into Porton Down, the Chemical and Biological Weapons Centre near Salisbury. And I think what we'll do is we will have a chat to Martin in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world.
Most of us just sell out right away.